defense. Here we have for today's entrepreneur session with entrepreneur and angel investor Rajiv Macheri. Welcome, Rajiv.
Hi.
A quick word about Rajiv. Rajiv is a first generation entrepreneur. He co-founded along with his brother a Chennai-based security and building automation firm, iMetrics Technologies, in 1992. After building the company into a 160 crore, 620 employee organization, he sold iMetrics to Siemens in 2007. At the time of acquisition, iMetrics had operations in Ireland, England, Singapore, and Hong Kong. As part of iMetrics' journey, Rajiv also raised VC funding, and through the journey, he's also acquired a company, an Irish-based company. Currently, Rajiv runs an investment firm, Macheri Capital, that is currently invested in 5 early-stage businesses. Rajiv is also a chapter member in Tide Chennai, and he's invested in through Chennai Angels. He's also past chapter chairman of Young Presidents Association, YPO, Chennai, and founding member of the Entrepreneurs Organization, YPO Chennai. As an exemplary alumnus of ISEC, an International Students Association, Rajiv was recently awarded the Global Hall of Fame in the ISEC list. Welcome, Rajiv, once again. Just to start with, probably we would like to hear a little from you about your schooling and college, and what you did in school and college that inspired you in your journey next.
Okay. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure being here this evening. I actually grew up in my early stages of life in Tuticorin, in Tamil. Did my schooling until class 6 out there. Born in a family which was predominantly service class. My father was a chartered accountant, worked for a company, only one company over 30 years, and rose up to be the president of that company. So he and loyalty go way hand in hand. Of course, was brought up in an environment of values which were about relationships, about trust, about what all most parents do to their children, and was not so focused on becoming an entrepreneur or anything like that, but it was always that given an opportunity to say, would you like to try something, he would always be open to encouraging us, especially my father. So he would let us try things and learn from our mistakes. So that was probably some seed of entrepreneurship, but would never insist on. Would never insist on things to be done in a certain way. So we were not conformists in any which way as well. So those were some fundamental basis of which on which we decided to try to venture. So I grew up in Tuticorin until class 6, moved to Chennai in class 7. That was predominantly because my father felt, both of us, me and my brother. So pretty much I will speak most of the time as me, because me and Anand, we are two sides of a coin. So we both moved to Chennai predominantly because we felt we needed a city education from the point of being street smart. If you grow up in a sort of quasi-village environment, you probably could be academically bright, but you don't know the ways and means of the city. So with that in mind, came into the city, joined Don Bosco school. I was sticking out like a sore thumb for sure for some time, but still managed to get along and do well afterwards. And then went to Loyola, to the BCom. Up until then, I was predominantly an academics-focused student, where before I joined Loyola, I would have preferred to go for an evening college, do my ICWA entrance, and prepare for an ICWA course, so on and so forth. But then when I joined Loyola, I think a lot of my life changed. Loyola was an incredibly good experience for two reasons. One, the opportunity the college offered, the kind of friends and the network I built over there. And third, also the the fact that I had an opportunity to be part of a great organization called ISET. So that is the long and short of my early college days and school days. And I, okay, just to complete the education bit, I finished Loyola and then decided I didn't continue my education within post-graduation at that point. At that point, most of my classmates would have preferred to go for an MBA, or people didn't work for 2-3 years to get a job and then go for an MBA. Immediately they would go for an MBA in the US or wherever else. I didn't try that because of two reasons. One, I decided to run for a position in ISET at a national level. I got elected and I moved to Bombay to work one full year on a voluntary basis. After that, I got an opportunity to work in the US with a company called Babcock & Wilcox. Initially on a 17-week internship that turned out to be almost a year experience, and then they wanted me to continue working for the company. But by then, the changes in India in 1992, the liberalization and the opportunities for becoming an entrepreneur drew me back to India. And of course, at that point of time, the fact that life, according to me, is all about memories and relationships. And living in the US for maybe 10, 15, 20 years with 200 days of memory of friends and family was not enough. So I decided to come back. So.
Great. So in a sense, ISET's journey was itself an entrepreneurial thing, step that you took in and then...
Yes. ISET was an interesting experience because ISET actually stands for... It used to be it's a French acronym for International Association of Students in Economics and Management. The whole idea is that it gives you an opportunity to explore life in as in real life, but and in the make-believe world, where you run an organization of 1,500 members. You have a budget. You have responsibilities to manage the team. You have reporting. Lines to the national office and also to the board of advisors, and you also have stakeholders which are corporate companies which invest in ISET. So the whole experience is all about how the members go through the ISET experience and become better managers for tomorrow. So without having to severely get impacted monetarily, you can make mistakes and learn. So it's a good learning experience. I always used to say it's like a game of football, where if you want to become a good football player, as in real life, you know, a battle, ISET was a great experience because I could make several mistakes in dealing with people, losing money, not accounting things, or whatever else. And at the end of it, I personally didn't get impacted and I became a better individual. The organization gave me the platform.
So, how did the idea of Dads India at the time come up? What was the event like? Standard is Dads India, technology solutions. So how did that come? How did that strike you?
Okay. I think I should say what our business was to the audience and who are viewing. Primarily, our business was we were a solution provider in the safety, security, and automation solution space, which meant that security would mean intrusion protection, perimeter protection, access control, video surveillance. Safety would be fire alarm, fire suppression. Automation would be building controls, air conditioning, gen set, UPS, water management, and so on and so forth. Now, typically, if you walk into my office in 2001 and you moved into an intelligent building, now today you hear about carbon footprint, green buildings. This is exactly what we do. Now, if you walk into my office, it was like it was like a Hollywood movie experience because you flash your card at the entrance. You not only have your time and attendance, your access control, your interface to ERP, your other inputs. See, we also actually monitor the building occupancy controls. So typically, when you flash your card, your lights in the room get switched on, your air conditioning gets switched on. It is a very intelligent way of managing an office. So using occupancy information, we trigger various outputs which will make the building more energy efficient as well as which will make it more safe and convenient. So our objective was to make our buildings more convenient, more safe, and more energy efficient. So we were able to do all this in a very intelligent way, quite unlike what the multinationals were doing, using the concept of occupancy controls. And we were also the first to have created a one single platform to integrate all the subsystems. Even today, it is not a common practice to have all of them on one common interface. We developed an application which managed safety, security, and automation for our customer. And it also was partitioned for multiple sites for each of these systems. So one of our largest installations from a multiple site perspective was Reliance Infocom in 2002, whose memory got awarded, was about 4,000 sites. Each of the remote sites was independently managed. You could have, when they set up a control room, they call it the SNOC, like the NOC which they have, which most of you have seen the pictures, to manage the remote sites. So you will be able to manage remote sites from a central location, and you're able to recover costs much easier, instead of having a security guard, instead of having wastage of fuel, and so on and so forth. So the whole idea was to make customers build intelligent buildings rather than conventional buildings. So our objective was quite, it was a path-breaking effort, because most customers did not know what were security systems. Then only comes the fact that you're building an intelligent building. So first is to convince them to put in these systems, and then to make it even more intelligent, to have a single application layer to manage everything. And then of course, to say that set up a control room to manage that, and also to have operators who can manage that. They're all additional investments, but unless and until they invest and they see the value and they recover costs, they're not convinced. So it took us some time to convince customers to go that direction. But today, I think it's becoming more and more a norm for most large IT companies or large developers to consider a fully automated intelligent building. So your question was, how did this...
Given that your background was more into commerce, this seems very high tech and like matrix.
For starters, I was hardly technical. I worked my time and put in the effort to learn the subject. And after a period of time, I became as technical as one can get. Of course, for the entire company, my brother was the guru, so he was my guru as well. So the idea was that I had my brother to fall back on and take advice or inputs was a great advantage. I don't think he had help, but I had an advantage. But considering that we were a combination of one being focused on marketing and one being focused on the technical aspects of the business, it was a great combination. So if you, and of course we had another fellow director who handled operations as well. So as a threesome, we were a great combination to deliver to our customers an appropriate solution. So how did the thought process come about? It was in 92, and pretty much we had invested in a startup security manufacturing company. And my brother had come back from engineering college and spent some time. But it was completely caught in front of the horse, because we were manufacturing alarm controllers. And these controllers were not, you know, there was nobody who knew what to do with these controllers. So we had to create a channel over time. And at that point is when we realized that it will take us a whole lot of time to build a channel and make them competent and create the opportunity for ourselves. And at that point we said, why not we became a system integrator? So there was a differential, there was a difference in mindset between us and the other investors, so we exited the business. In 92 we decided to start a system integration company focused on providing services in the security space across, and I would say South. We started in Chennai. Bangalore was not as much a big market at that point. We had a few customers spread over in a few metros. But then it became slowly a national organization. By and large, catering to customers who were growing, and we grew based on customer needs. So if a new customer, one of our oldest and most loyal customers was Citibank. Citibank was our first international customer. And when Citibank actually called us from an Yellow Page advertisement saying, do you know to install an intruder alarm system as per British standards, which is their standards as well. We were there to support them. They, even the gentleman who was, you know, handling the security portfolio itself needed clarity on a few products. So it was a few bunch of products we put into a bag and took all of them and showed him what these products were all about and how we could provide a full solution. So he was quite impressed with what we could do, and we started our relationship there and became slowly a sort of a single window provider for CityMind across the country, not just at that point, until the time we exited the business in 2010.
So what you're saying is you started as an investor and then you went into the business yourself as an entrepreneur, and then now back you're again an angel investor.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say started out as an investor, because my father was our investor.
Sure.
So he was the angel for me, and so I would not say I've had a difficult time as a startup. I had a roof on top, I had food to eat, and I had a reasonable lifestyle, and you know, just reasonably comfortable. So I didn't have those basic need challenges, and I was not married, and I didn't have a family, and I didn't have to provide for more people than myself. So it was quite simple from that perspective. You know, I needed money for fuel, and I needed money to entertain people once in a day as customers, and that's all I need money in my pocket. I didn't need any other cash flow. And my needs were very, mine, when I say my brothers, both of us, were needs were limited. We would work till 9, 9:30 in the night, so we don't have much time to go out and spend. Weekends are pretty much are also working time, so we didn't have too many needs. All that we needed was the basic infrastructure, which was provided by my father. He also provided us the seed capital, which was over time in smaller amounts, all would have, you know, would have amounted to about 20 lakhs over the first 2, 3, 4 years. Subsequent to that, at one point he took a call saying that, listen, if you guys need to find, to build a business, you need to find your money. You need to make a business profitable. You need to make the business competent enough for it to sustain in the long run. If you expect that I keep funding you over time, wiping away my life savings, I won't. So clearly he was clear, he was the seed capital, but that at a certain point took the call that, you know, you have to find your way. So it was not, from that point it was not that easy. We didn't have any other source of funding, so we needed to find ways to ingeniously manage our needs, which at times required us to go and seek help from friends, and sometimes go to the market, but not raise money in stupid terms. Also, work with bankers and find a way for them to convince them to give us some money. That was obviously a big challenge as well.
Sure. So when you started, did you have a business plan, or did you write a business plan? How did it pan out in the first 2, 3 years?
Okay. I mean, in today's context, we are all a lot more knowledgeable. We write business plans, we think through the whole plan, we go to the market, do several surveys, and we are reasonably clear it will be a success, and then only we venture. And I think I'm talking 20 years back, so I would not claim to have been so intelligent and so sophisticated at that point of time. I went to 2 things, gut and good luck. Gut was the fact that I knew that this was a great opportunity because I did not see several people installing them. I did not see several installers for that matter. I also knew, with limited travels around the world and reading, that this is the way the world needs to go. When prosperity comes, there is more security threats. People need to find ways to secure their loved ones, and alarm systems were definitely a means for them to protect their families. So we knew this is the way it will go, but whether we knew it will lead into automation, no. Whether we knew it will lead into integration to ERP systems, no. So I would claim the ability to envision all that. But we knew theory that this was a great opportunity. We knew theory that this can give us success. But we were, at that point, in 1992, fresh out of college, I would not have envisaged that the business would grow to anything more than 100 crores. Of course, when we were in the starters, for starters, we would have been happy if it hit 10 crores as a business. And at a certain point, we targeted ourselves to be a 100 crore company. And then, of course, the goal was to be a 500 crore company and so on and so forth. It may not have subsequently didn't pan out the way we want. I will talk about it later. But from a valuation perspective and other things, it move in that direction. So obviously, the answer to your question is not, and good luck.
Yeah. And Rajiv, we were also talking about your brother being the partner in your business, and you said there was a lot of that. So how did you expand or recruit the initial team beyond that? I know you had a very solid founding team, complementary skills. And how did you recruit and throughout the next 10 years, 15 years, how did you find managing people, recruiting people? Was that a challenge? And how did you come across?
The initial bunch of people, some key people were through personal relationships. There were a few friends from ISEC who came on board. There were others who we knew. Like the way, if any of you are planning to be an entrepreneur, you would look at classmates, you know, or people whom you know well, who you think you would be able to wire, and there is chemistry. So we put a small team together over time in that context, and also a lot of it was trial and error. Few cases we made mistakes. They were wrong people. They were ethically certainly not the right fit. Sometimes attitudinally very poor. But you have to find ways to exit from those relationships as quickly as possible and move on. Of course, without as much as possible without burning bridges. It's not easy, but you've got to find a way to move on from those relationships. So putting together the team at that point was probably one of the serious challenges, because we do not have the credibility for us to attract good talent. We do not have the brand for people to, you know, feel comfortable to work with us. All that was visible for them to meet with us and understand what our vision was and understand how sincere we are in our approach. And that we had lots of it. And we were definitely would be very, very sincere in everything which we do. And you know, and we would be honest and transparent in our approach. And that sort of worked well for us.
So how did the transition from iMetrix to Siemens happen? Why did the decision come about, and how did you take it?
Actually, before we became Siemens, I mean, I would, within our industry, we were by and large the largest player at that point of time. I would say from early stage, where we have issues of credibility, cash flow, and crew, which is people. At the mid stage, we had another set of challenges. So we didn't straight away go to the Siemens stage. Retention became an issue at a certain point. We had profitability issues as well, the ability to maintain the profitability which we were having in the early years, and operational efficiency. Because the minute you are a single location company, we are the projects business, so let me go back to that. We are the projects business, and we are also a services company, and we were also in the security industry. All these are tough combinations. And within the parameters of what I stated, it is extremely difficult to retain customers and keep them happy, because very often the customer did not know what was required as such. What they need is we are helping them define it. And once we define that, their expectations grow so high, and they expect that we manage. At a certain stage, when you hand over the system, they have to operate the system for them to see the efficiencies. That very often may not happen as well as what they want, and we have to manage those balances. So those mid-stage challenges as well. The late stage, or in our own evolution, was moving as Siemens. So to trace some of our steps back, the first step was, how do we move from being a 40-50 crore company to the next stage of being a 100 crore or a 500 crore company? What are the steps to do? We clearly knew that at that stage, your passion could get you to a certain point. Your vision and your team also could get you to a certain point. But you need to have the financial wherewithal to get to the next level. So we did not have a need for money at that point. We were an extremely profitable business. If we had to make it a lifestyle business, it would have been brilliant to keep it at that phase and keep it, you know, very profitable. But we had a goal larger than that. We wanted to be a national organization. We wanted to have an international footprint. We also wanted to own a brand, a global brand. So with that in mind, we clearly knew we don't have the financial wherewithal to take us to the next step. So at that point, we decided that we will raise priority. So to be honest, when we started that whole exercise, this was way back in 2002, early 2002. So private equity, venture capital was not so well known at that point. To be honest, I had not heard venture capital at that point. And someone came and had a chat with us about venture capital. They give you money and take some equity. That's a rough explanation. So we said, fine, let's talk to somebody. So through that process, and a few of them came and talked to us, pitched to us, we understood how this whole game plans. Until then, from there on, and actually even before that, when we knew that this is the direction we would like to go, we started preparing the business for the venture capital phase. Very often, most entrepreneurs have high dependency of their business. They need the business for their lifestyle. They need the business needs them for sure, because they need to grow the business. But they also need the business for lifestyle and an identity. But we decided that at least from a lifestyle perspective, we should make it independent. So pretty much became focused to becoming very transparent, stop looking costs which are not relevant to the business, keeping it very clean and very transparent. So the minute we started talking to a VC firm, we knew exactly what they were looking for. We started getting, and they, I think, also had the vibe that, you know, we are already ready. It's not that they needed to work on us. So we had already put in place reporting systems, and within the first 3 to 6 months from the time they came on board, we pretty much were up there from all the expectations. We were not, you know, our reports would be on time, our governance was top of the line, and they were extremely comfortable with what we had to say and what the plans were. So when we put the money, when they put the money in the company, and they put in for a certain purpose, and at that point there was a dramatic shift in the way the business could change in the future. One of our partner companies was likely to be sold. So we decided to pitch for it. So that sort of transitioned us to the next phase, and that sort of led us to Siemens as well.
So this is the company that you ended up acquiring.
Yes.
Can you give us an insight of how did the acquisition process happened?
Yes.
Why did it start? How did it start? How did it come through MA?
The company was Europlex Technologies. They were a second partner who started working with us in 1994. In 1995, on account of, I would say it was a sort of a part-time effort, even to say that it was my brother's hobby, that we decided to create a Windows-based product, an application, because this company had a DOS-based application for an access control system. So we knew in pretty much in India, if you go to a customer and start offering DOS-based products, even though at that time Windows was still not as popular, we may not have an edge. So we said we created a Windows-based application. And we sent it to this supplier, this partner company. They pretty much liked what we had to offer. And they asked us, can you share the source code with us? And you could say we were naive, or we could say we were, you know, shrewd, whatever it was, or we had the good fortune. We just simply decided to give them the source code. Because the application is of no value if they don't think that there is value to the whole application, because it will work only with their control. But we didn't make the whole process very complicated. We didn't make it very difficult for them to do business with us. So that sort of set the benchmark for engaging with us, and that we were clean, easy to deal with partners in India. Slowly they asked us to start supporting them in other products they wanted developed, and to sit in the UK to support some of the installations they'd gone about with our products. It is not a very large body shopping operation. We had 3-4 people there, but we had lots of learnings from those processes. We knew how the European market was changing as well. So we built knowledge through that experience. But we also had this pretty interesting experience, because we were were buying products from them, and every time close to Christmas, they would ship goods on in Kuryamo. And I'm sure all of you would not even have had that experience, or would never have this experience, because those were the times when customs duty was about 120%. And if you end up bringing in goods on Kuryamo, you have a penalty to pay. The penalty was 50% of the actual duty. So we end up paying 180%, sometimes it would be even more. So if the product costed $100 and if you end up paying close to $200 or more on customs duty, it's unviable to sell in India. But still the number of the sales, the number of controllers sold were very limited. So we were managing, two, three times they made the mistake, and the final time when they made the mistake, our supply chain logistics head went to Bombay, sat with the customs guy and said, listen, we can't afford it, we leave it here. We left the whole consignment and went back to this company and said, listen, you guys are making this mistake again and again, and we can't afford it. And we had an opportunity to chat with their management about this. And they turned around and we said, we would like to manufacture your products in India. What will it take for us to do? I guess they reciprocated it, or maybe they thought that India is not a big market or whatever it was. They just simply pretty much handed over sort of a barter deal to give us the controllers, the circuit diagrams for all the controllers and all that of one generation. But having started working on that and setting up a manufacturing plant in Pondicherry, another plant again, we learned a lot, and we in the process became a developer for hardware products as well, and we started. They started outsourcing work to us in that space as well. So it sort of helped us scale. So when this company in 2002 was pretty much up for sale, because their sales started dropping dramatically, we did not want to let go. One, we were dependent on their product in India. We had a plant, we had a successful business built upon them. So it did not make sense. So we decided to work with the management team of that company to acquire the business. So the management team put in a bid for a management buyout, and we supported it from the outside. So that's how it started. And then ultimately, we became a majority owner of the company, and that company was merged into our India business. And there again, in 2005, we still thought at that point, for a solutions company to buy a product company was not very appropriate, because the opportunity for the solution for the product company across the world with other system integrators would reduce. So we created a structure where it was a holding group called Ametrix Group, which had an India-centric solutions business and a global product business under European. So that's how we became Ametrix Technologies.
So you were saying when you were trying to raise funds, you said you already had a structure in place. So did you have a board already? Did you have a structure, board, or board of advisors, or did it come post investment?
At that point, given we did not have any external directors, we had one board of financial advisor. Pretty much others were family members or members of the DAX family, all the rest of the other promoters. We did not have exemplary professionals and so on and so forth. Idea was that we were starting to look at that, but we also thought that, let us look at raising equity and bringing in an external investor, and then go to an external board member or to talk to an external board member, because we needed to be of reasonable size and scale and credibility to go to someone and ask them to sit on the board as well.
Then later you built a board around the investors?
Yes, we had two more additional board members, and we were to also look at getting an external, an independent director. When we were at the plans where we would go for a listing, but things changed again. So we always believe in the company that change is the only constant. So, and we should always be open for change. Based not just on our processes, but based on how we think of the opportunities at hand. So we need to be dynamic in our thinking process too, and evolve ourselves. So that sort of, as that process, we changed our mind to exit.
So You said you've dealt with investors, so what's your experience dealing with investors, professional sector investors, and if probably for the benefit of the entrepreneurs, any pros and cons that you think you can say from?
I think there was one dictum for the company across pretty much all through our lives. What works for you, what works for the company works for you. Almost on every single decision, it will be, does it work for the company, then it will work for you. Pretty much to convince people, if you say that, take the decision based on if it works for the company. If you take a decision based on your, let me simply give an example. If sales guys would always want to take a decision based on their incentives. But the fact that sometimes their incentives are not aligned to the goals of the company, because the company needs to be profitable. If they go out and pick up projects which are poor in profitability, while their incentives would be, you know, quite good, obviously the company along the way would suffer. And there are several companies in our business which folded very quickly in 2 or 3 years after they started having trouble. Because our assets are our people. We don't build a strong asset base over time. And our customer relationships are one on the service side. We have annuity business which is not very large, because their install base is not that large. It's only over 5 or 7 years. Not many people are very comfortable paying a ton of money to maintain these. They will say, we will call you in for maintenance, and they anyway say your products don't fail. So pretty much you need to work with the customers to build the business again and again each time. The sales cycle is quite long. So you need to make sure, you know, you maintain these relationships, and which means you need to make sure you deliver value to the customer. You complete the project, make sure they're happy, you know, they're happy, make sure they're using it well, which is typically not in your rule book. You're not expected to make sure that they use the system. But by and large, we would go back and say, okay, if you improve it in this area, you would use it better and you'll find better value. So at that point, you know, the customer gets to have the satisfaction that we are aligned to their goals and they keep working with us. So keeping that in mind, it was over time that, you know, we were able to achieve this consistency between what is aligned for the business and what is aligned for the individuals who work for the company. Of course, the other going back to your
pros and cons for the entrepreneurs, companies.
So pretty much at that point this is the dictum based on which you will operate. So by and large, when we focused on that, almost all our issues were coming under what is right and how we need to get it done.
That's a great fundamental thing to keep in mind. What works for the business works for everyone else. So.
Yeah. And of course, I think your question is also with regard to investors. Let me go back to that. Of course, with an investor, the first thing to achieve is that they need to have trust that you are going to not run away with the money they invest in. The money they provide is for something which, you know, which will create value for them. So if you manage to achieve that trust, then you have broken the first hurdle. Second is to continue to provide transparency on where you are. You need to constantly keep them clear about what the challenges are and how we are dealing with those issues. And of course, focusing on keeping them involved. We also all the time would keep them involved in, if we are finding it difficult to crack a deal, we would say, help us. And so in that process, we were able to build trust and comfort and transparency.
Trust, transparency, yes. Rajiv, you were also mentioning about sales with examples of your salesmen. So how long did you run, or did your brother run the sales, and when did you delegate sales to the employees? And do you think, when would an entrepreneur want to or should transition sales, which is very key for any entrepreneur's sales life?
I would not say one has to be focused on any one particular function. I mean, somebody with a finance background would say collections is the most important thing, which is the lifeblood. Cash flow is extremely important. Cash is king. Somebody who's from the technology field, all your IITs will say, if my technology is good, I will track it. People will come to me and stand in a queue to buy my products. someone from my background who's people oriented, who fasts his way through to make his sales, would say sales is important. Whichever way it is, I would think customer touch point is very important. Whether you are going to be operationally focused in being in touch with the customer, or you're going to be focused on making sure the processes are in place, your governance is in place with it, and you engage with the customer on those points. But that's not very normally very positive engagement, because you're all the time fighting, you know, that against collections or in negotiating a contract. But when you are in a position of providing and sharing knowledge, you are in a position where you can build relationships. When they have a challenge, they call you, who ask you for the assistance, and you provide that sort of builds greater relationships. So while I would say customer touch point is important in any form of business, in any function, you know, whatever function the entrepreneur handles, but I would clearly say being in sales and marketing, you have the edge. So sometimes most successful entrepreneurs tend to focus on that a lot more, because you have an edge to be in touch with the customer.
And what are your key challenges? What are the key inflection points, or say your journey, that you think had the most impact in your business and the world?
I will first say what we did not do. I think when we reached a point of almost even 40 or 50 crores, we had the vision that for us to manage our business better, we needed an ERP. But like a typical startup, our thought process was, let us not spend too much money on this. We need information, but we can make do with a product which can work reasonably okay. I think that we compromised. When we started working with this company, it almost took them a year and a half to come to a point at least to you know, somewhat meet our requirements. And we lost time, and we killed that idea, and finally went into one of the big boys and invested lots of money in evolved ERP system. I think that was a big learning, that you got to take those right calls at the right time, and you got to look at these calls not as a today's cost, but as a long-term investment. If you can afford it in the long run, and if you see the, if you're able to envision the business to grow, you have to invest appropriately, at least in processes and in and of course, the other, on the positive side, what are the inflections? The decision to set up a manufacturing plant and to grow the business as an end-to-end provider was a big advantage, because most of our competitors were typically either system integrators who did not have the capability to generate margins across manufacturing and system integration. We had that ability, and we had the ability to be more competitive comes to push comes to shove in certain projects, because it was our own products we needed to. But at the same time, we prudent on that, not just go left, right, and center on that. So that was an important point of our business. And the third positive thing again would be to raise the private equity, raise the venture capital money. As I said, we did not have a need for the money, but because we had confidence and the money in the system, we could go out and agree with Europlex to invest in their business. If we had not done that, we would not have the opportunity to own a global brand and become a global player in a certain way, and for Siemens to have shown interest in us.
By your talking, you also mentioned about you being a distributor for other people's products while you were strictly competing with them.
No, in our early days, as a system integrator, we would provide full solutions, but we also needed to make sure the products we used in our solutions were available for other system integrators. So virtually, we were feeding products to our competitors. So at that point of time, a lot of us had said, isn't that not a very sensible thing to do? But it sort of helped us on two ends. One, we had market information through that channel. Second, we also had the ability to scale the sales for our partner companies, not just through our solutions, but also through our partner companies. And third, we were able to build an ability to build a complete new portfolio of products, which could be servicing the distribution market as well. Because we had a channel, we could build for Europe a portfolio of products which could only be used for distribution. So all that is not possible if in 95 we didn't think about the distribution strategy.
So I have a last two questions before that, if the audience wants to pick up some questions, we can think of three questions at the end. So, Rajiv, an entrepreneur is always an entrepreneur. So, how did you find being with a big corporate and then seeing such a big environment, processes? Can you take us through that? And
lots of learnings. I mean, I have a lot of respect for an organization like Siemens. There's a saying within Siemens, they say, Siemens does not know what Siemens knows. Pretty much that is true. One end of Siemens does not know what the other end of Siemens does or what they know. If you are an entrepreneur within the system, if you dig deep, you will find problems, you will find solutions to many, many problems which you will not find outside. That's one. Second, there is a lot of knowledge which what I said is not technology. If you look at people, it's 450,000 people across the world, across sectors which are energy, infrastructure, today's cities, and the other is power, healthcare. These are aspects of life which touches us on a day-to-day basis, and there is a lot of learning from these businesses. And so you're able to, for example, there was once a discussion about the windmill business. They said the windmills, it's called Winergy, and you sit down with them and you talk about it, you automatically quickly find an opportunity there. In the windmills, they were losing certain cables, there were certain products which been after installation, they used to have losses. So we were looking at how to solve them. So in each of the areas, you have, an input which you could provide or an opportunity which you can address. And of course, lastly, a brand like Siemens makes a huge difference. Until we were Siemens, it pretty much required that we provide our entire power scope to our customer. I mean, short of asking me my power scope, the customer would ask me all sorts of questions. What is the network? Who are the promoters? How profitable are you? Why should we do work with you? The minute we became Siemens, I was so surprised. The customer does not bother to ask anything about your competency, does not ask about anything about your financial strength, nothing. All that he wants to know is what price will you go to. So the sales process becomes extremely easy on one hand. And it is also quite difficult to keep the sales team motivated to go out and create new opportunities. Because it's so easy for, being Siemens to get access to new opportunities. Almost everybody would want Siemens to win. In many cases, it is the ability to service the requirements which come. You pretty much, are busy with only doing that. That sometimes also could lead to challenges. Because if you just look at only addressing the needs which come to you, then you're not creating the opportunities. If you're not creating the opportunities, you're not out there creating those relationships. And if you're not creating those relationships, the tenders and the requirements which come out which will be with somebody else's information. Right? There is always everybody's effort is to go out and create those, specifications which will sort of somewhat support someone else. And you've got to be there to make sure it suits your product specification. So you tend to lose out on that. But for that, if your one is able to address that, it's a great place to work. But at the same time, of course, as you said, it's a large organization. Things don't happen that fast. If you don't have the patience, you could become, you could get irritated about the red tape and the bureaucracy sometimes. But it is important to understand that large organizations have created a a certain structure because, and they have fitted almost every country into a certain structure, essentially because there's no other better way for them to handle it. You can't create a structure for each country. There's no easy way to manage a global organization. So you cannot custom build a multinational. You have to make sure you know it's all tight fitted into a certain mold. And that sometimes is a bit of a challenge. But if you understand that it is done for a certain purpose, you'll see the logic and you'll be able to operate with that framework.
Okay, thanks. Rajiv, finally, what are your plans ahead? You know, for Machedi Smart Capital?
I did clarify that I finished my BCom and got into business. So that was one aspiration which I had, that I wanted to go back to school. So I'm actually now back in school as well. I'm doing an executive program at the Chicago Booth School. It's the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. I do a program which takes me to class 10 days or 8 days a month. It's almost 10 days of travel out of home. So that has been keeping me busy for almost 18 months now. I finished it. It's a 21-month program with campuses in Singapore, London, and Chicago. So that is one part. And the other is, of course, investing in early stage startups has been a very good learning experience. Going forward, the idea is to go back to the building industry. Not essentially back to what we were doing in the past, but be in the building industry and looking at opportunities in the building industry. Maybe partially as a developer in a niche segment. Maybe partially as a technology provider for the building industry. Those are up in the air right now. In the next few months, we will have clarity to all of them.
Thanks, Rajiv.